Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey, you guys.
Hi, how are ya?
Happy day.
Happy day that ends in Y. For us, it's a fucking Fri-yay over here.
It is a Fri-yay, and it could not have come at a better Fri-yay time.
It is fry needed.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you guys also had like a century of a week asking for a friend?
And also
us.
Yeah, because I think I need a nap and I might see you guys in February.
I gotta be so for real. The fact that I got through this week without picking up a chain smoking habit is like maybe my biggest feat yet.
Abby, who's never smoked a cigarette.
I have never touched a cigarette, and every single day this week I've been like, you know what I could use?
A cigarette.
A cigarette.
A cool crisp morning and a cigarette outside.
I was like, maybe we'll get like a little tasting, like a charcuterie board, see what we like. And then I was like, no, the second I do that, I'm never putting them down. I can't touch them. But man, sometimes it seems real nice.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we're here to talk about even more depravity.
Yeah. So buckle in.
Because did you have a shortage of depravity in your life?
Not anymore. We have the show for you.
Mm-hmm. This is Allie Smalls and Abby Talls coming at you live. You like
that's
that?
Good. That is good.
Thank you. Just came to me.
Wow. I like it.
Mm. Well, that's the only laugh we're going to have. So.
Oh my gosh. Hopefully. But. All right. I guess we're going to hop into it because today is kind of a heavy one. So hi, hello, and welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime. Welcome to part two of our Dean Coral series. And while last week you heard much of the necessary context for what we know of Dean's childhood, how he came to grow into who he was, and the circumstances in which he came to die, there is a lot more to discuss. There is a lot of horror and a lot of crime in the middle, and we're going to hop into that now. So if you haven't listened to part one, go do that. We'll wait.
Okay, good.
Okay, hi. Welcome back.
Good job.
You did it. Okay, as per the usual, just some sources and trigger warnings. For sources, we used a lot from Texas Monthly, a book by Jack Olson called The Man with the Candy, and some great research and coverage of this case from The Casual Criminalist, and many, many more, all of which are in that document you can find linked below.
It is so long, you guys.
Yeah.
But if you want to know where we got all of the things that we're talking about, you definitely want to reference that.
Yes, and it's got... I mean, this is everything we touch on to find any of the information we tell you. So if I even look at it and I don't remember an exact quote I use, I put it in there.
It's there.
Yep. But I also just wanted to give a really big shout out to one article today called The Lost Boys from Texas Monthly. It is just incredibly informative and really phenomenal journalism. So if you're looking for one that really goes in depth on some people, that's a really great one to start with. But... for the trigger warnings, today we are specifically getting into some child grooming, sodomy and rape, pedophilia, and throughout we will continue to see themes of human and child trafficking, as well as drug abuse.
And depravity and torture.
Yeah.
And evil.
Yeah.
Actual evil.
I will give you a pretty solid trigger warning on the extremely graphic parts, but know that all of it's graphic, so please proceed with caution. It's real bad. It's real bad, and it doesn't get better.
Mm-mm.
No.
Nope.
So, we left off last week talking about how Dean Coral, perceived nice guy, honorably discharged veteran, who took up working and even running his mother's candy store, started using this as a ploy to talk with children, gain their trust, and generally start to groom them. It's around this time that we meet David Brooks, one of Dean's longest and most pertinent allies and accomplices, but also... one of his longest victims.
David Brooks was born February 12, 1955. We know very little about David's life, because when all was said and done, aside from his confession to the police, he kept his mouth shut about what happened for all of those years. Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., who we'll talk a lot about later, was far more vocal, and he's the one that you've probably seen recently who sat for that interview. But David... he came from a poor family in a broken home. When he was in elementary school, he was one of those very same kids who lined up to get the candy that Dean handed out. David's parents were divorced, and while his dad stayed in Houston, his mother moved to Beaumont, Texas, an hour and a half east of Houston, and not far from Vidor, which I heard is how you pronounce it.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. That's helpful.
David began spending time with Dean, and Dean was the only one who didn't bully him for his glasses or call him mean names. David's dad wasn't kind to him and kicked him out of the house and called him names. And I saw it referenced in the book that his dad would refer to him as like the F word for gay people. Like, mm-hmm. So that was like a name that he was called a lot at home. So you can understand why he didn't want to be there. But because David's dad was like that, there was kind of that hole in David's life, and Dean seemed to fill in that role in David's eyes.
Yeah.
Like, David looked up to him and he kind of idolized him. David was very skinny and nerdy and would definitely have not been viewed as strong or intimidating, which might have been both part of the appeal to Dean, as well as why David might have felt he needed protecting. Dean had slowly been working on grooming David since he first met him when he was 12. So 2 years of a young boy's life where he had somewhere to go and someone to show him kindness when no one else really did. When he was about 14, Dean's approaches had also morphed to keep him interested to include parties. Like we said last episode, to a younger kid, soda, candy, and a place to hang out were desirable. But as kids got older, so did Dean's plans. Dean began supplying alcohol, drugs, music. He had a black light and a pool table.
Yeah.
Dean began paying David to allow Dean to perform oral sex on David. So Dean began, at least at this point, confirmed raping a minor.
Yeah.
David was an outsider. He had very few friends with little to no support. And then enter Dean, who was shown kindness to him he's never had before. And Dean spent years fostering this relationship with David. He gave him candy. And this was candy that David's family could not have even afforded to buy him if they even would have bought it for him.
Right.
Dean gave David spending money or just other gifts. So he's now given money that his parents could have never afforded to give him.
Mm-hmm.
And then you enter the sexual acts. Now, a minor can never consent to sex with an adult. By definition, this is rape of a child. Whether these acts were forcible, we don't really think so. It seems more that David was coerced into participating in this by an adult who had already gained his trust and who already held a role of authority over him. David was on the receiving end of this sexual assault, though it's probably not how he would have described it. Children who are victims of sexual abuse often feel a slew of emotions. And one of the prevailing ones is shame. Shame for feeling like they could or should have stopped what was happening. Shame for the violation that they feel. And often, shame for their body's response to the act itself.
Mm.
Take out the social and moral elements of it, but at its core, we are programmed to biologically enjoy and seek sexual gratification. If the Neanderthals didn't enjoy sex to some extent and providing an incentive to continue doing it, then there wouldn't have been enough sex to make more of them and blah, blah, blah. Here we all are, and you're sitting or walking or driving where you are listening to me. And that's all because thousands of people before you had sex and then you came along.
Yay!
In case you were wondering. Or maybe a stork dropped you off. I don't know. I'm not you. All of this to say that victims of all ages, and especially children, who experience a kind of sexual assault might also enjoy is maybe not the right word, but their body will respond in a way that it is enjoying it, at least the sensation of it. Their body's reacting to stimuli regardless of the emotional or mental element. It's often involuntary, like a sneeze. And David might have been too young to understand the gravity of what was happening to him, but it did have its impact.
Right. Well, and the intricate nature of the relationship between David and Dean was something we really wanted to highlight. As many of you who have listened to us know before, I, Abby, am what I like to call an armchair psychologist. I do have a degree in psychology, and I've worked in and around crisis and family counseling, but I don't have letters to diagnose. I don't practice therapy myself. And even if I did, or hopefully one day do, this podcast is not any kind of psychological professional authority, and it is genuinely just like musings and my thoughts. I do read the DSM-5 for fun, but I think that's maybe just me oversharing at this point. So there's that. We did want to take note and just take some time to talk about some of the psychology wrapped up in all of this for David, and who we'll meet later as well, Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., the longstanding victims as well as accomplices to Dean. Now, I don't have children, but I do have a pretty good IQ and a lot of resources for child development, psychology, and a pretty good conceptualization for connecting the two. Dean starts grooming David when he's like 12, right? So David's getting candy from Dean, and not only getting this last week as like a gift, but he's also getting attention and basically things that would feel cool to any kid. He's getting adult special attention, basically. He's getting these gifts. He's getting gifts that he's probably not receiving at home. And then you raise the weight of all of this by remembering that anything that was going on at David's home probably wasn't either this friendly in terms of attention with all of the conflict and tension from the divorce, or this nice because they were dealing with a lot of financial problems. And between a divorce and parents that live far away in the 70s, Dean was offering these physical and emotional gifts that David wasn't getting anywhere else. Without getting too terribly philosophical, which is not the point, a basic theory of child development is that there are some things we are born knowing how to do, some things we develop naturally into doing, and some that we develop by learning how others do it. We're born knowing how to blink and how to breathe. That makes sense. And as you get older, things you develop are like puberty. Your body develops. You don't really have to do anything for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't happen when you're a baby. It happens later on. But the part that's really tricky for most people with child development is the learned elements, this like moral and social development. And that's like when it comes to viewing yourself as a part of a family, an individual, part of a society, and how that means we interact with others, as well as how we believe we should act apart from those roles. The biggest and main teachers, although not the only ones, for this social behavior are your caregivers. And for most kids, this is typically parents. There's also close adults in your life, like school teachers, babysitters or nannies, coaches, or other close like adult family friends that you might look up to that can sort of fill in this role.
Mm-hmm.
It should go without saying that every family looks different, but when we talk about kids like David, the social development is tricky because as a young child, his caregivers were likely his parents. And I'm sure they did not do nothing, but when another adult like Dean gets introduced at a vital age and is allowed not only so much access to David, but is allowed unchecked access during these formative years, he also would likely enter sort of a caregiver role in David's eyes. Further, Dean gave David money, which was probably wonderful in itself, but it was kind of like whenever he needed it. And he'd allow him a place to go consistently. And before he started introducing the sexual acts and assault, and all around, like, outside of this very rancid abuse, he would have very much likely seemed to David like a father figure as an older man providing all of this in such a positive way. And yes, we know that from descriptions and reviews that David himself gave that he saw Dean like a father, but just imagine what it would be like to be 12 years old who has the support of someone who is just like you, like an older version of you, man, woman, whoever you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they are giving you this care, providing for you, but also giving the support that you're not getting elsewhere. Like, of course, that's going to be someone that you kind of idolize in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think that like different adults in your life kind of fill in different roles and you learn different things from different people, and that's really valuable. And David didn't have a great relationship with his parents, so Dean has kind of like filled all of these buckets for right. him. Like, there is no diversity in that. And Dean is like late 20s, early 30s, so it's not like he's like 65 and
right.
it's drawing attention, and it seems kind of weird. Like, when you're young and a teenager, it's kind of cool to hang out yeah. with like older people, maybe not quite that age, but like maybe like if Dean were 22, it would be like the coolest thing in the world for a 12-year-old to think, wow, this guy thinks I'm special, I must be cool,
right?
And you know, he's giving me attention, and that's not anything that's happening anywhere else, or at least not good attention.
Right. It kind of reminds me of the concept of like cool older cousins, where it's like they're just old enough that you don't relate on a ton of things. You just look up to all the things they're doing, but close enough.
And then
enough,
they let you in and they're like, oh, do you want to come out with us? And you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And you're close enough for that, but not close enough to like live together and fight like siblings. I don't know. In my head, it's just like the peak idolism of like, oh, I want to be like you. I want to do the things you're doing. We aren't close enough for anything to be bad, but we aren't far enough for me to feel out of touch here and out
exactly.
of reach. So just interesting to imagine that role for him, sort of separate from, you know, even just the things he says, because we know David and Wayne, they both say a lot of things and you can take a lot of that, but I think it's different to really imagine yourself in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite resources for literally anything child development wise is healthychildren.org, and they have a great piece on healthy sexual development in children. And yes, okay, it's gross to talk about because most everyone who's normal does not want to think about this. Even when parents have kids with problem sexual behavior, it can be tough to like sit through and talk through because, like that's a kid and we're adults and that's not for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's weird.
And I totally get that. And I very much relate. But it is important because sexual behavior is behavior. And while part of it is, yes, hormone driven, part of it is a choice. It's the behavior and behaviors learned. And healthy sexual development includes both understanding the biological development as well as the behavioral choices. Also, knowing what behavior is healthy and normal helps identify in people you love, and also in cases like this, what behavior is not healthy and how you might want or need to intervene to correct this behavior. For someone David's age, he would likely fall into late childhood or puberty. Although obviously we wouldn't know specifically, to me it seems possible this started right around puberty or immediately after. When he met Dean, that is. As most children go through it between 11 to 13, and also David was already self-conscious and showing other like non-sexual behavior that relates to puberty, I'd put him in that category.
That seems fair.
But studies suggest that the attitude of parents and caregivers, their style of parenting, peer relationships, and cultural influences are all major factors that determine sexual attitudes of adolescents or their kids. Typical, normal, healthy sexual development and behavior for kids in late childhood and puberty include a growing and working understanding of the reproductive process, starting to develop emotional and sexual urges towards others, thinking about or starting masturbation, as well as worrying about all of the above, as other parts of this developmental stage is like starting to view yourself as an individual from outside and panicking about being super self-conscious all the time, which is why every middle schooler is probably just exhausted.
Yeah, you're like, don't perceive me, but also how am I being perceived?
Right, and also, am I doing the right thing? Are
yes.
you doing the right thing? Like, what's cool? What's right? What's me?
Exactly.
We know from other studies that childhood maltreatment or any kind of emotional, physical, verbal abuse or neglect can lead to a range of negative self-perceptions related to their sexual functioning, including feelings of inadequacy as sexual partners, unworthiness in sexual pleasure, guilt for experiencing pleasure, and difficulty asserting or expressing their sexual needs and desires. I bring this up only to say that if we take the sexual abuse that starts happening out of it entirely, if David's life was that he has described, I think it makes sense that he'd already have some of this negative self-perception. If the financial struggles led to parents that were actively trying to survive fiscally, and that means they'd be around less, like working all the time or working different shifts, or behaviors that led to and occurred around the divorce of David's parents, which usually includes like fighting and not getting along, and you know, perhaps they did it in a very civil way, but it's still emotionally exhausting for everyone involved. If any of this happened when David was a child and living there, it likely led him to be emotionally or otherwise neglected. And he may already be going into this time period with those negative self-perceptions, that shame around sex, that guilt for having it or expressing it, that feeling that he shouldn't or wouldn't be worthy of it anyway.
This also isn't a time where it likely would have been talked about at home anyway. And then you add on the kind of like chaos at home, and it probably definitely, probably very likely wasn't talked about. So,
well, and then you take into consideration like the relationship that David said he's had with his father was strained at best. Like, if someone that you know is calling you slurs, how likely are you to open up to them and be vulnerable about your development in an area that they're calling you a slur in?
Mm-hmm.
And how receptive would they be even if you were brave enough to be vulnerable with them as a kid? Exactly. And so again, like, in my opinion, it seems very likely that all of those logistical challenges would impact him at least on some level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was probably already going into this relationship feeling pretty bad about himself in this way. But then you bring in Dean as someone that David looks up to, right? Not only would it likely be confusing for someone navigating all of these boundaries and dynamics and feelings for the first time in puberty, but then for your role model or caretaker to start changing those boundaries and dynamics into more sexual ones might feel even more confusing. He could have taken it as flattering, potentially enjoyable, and even soothed some of those negative self-perceptions to believe that someone David looks up to would consider him desirable. And also, that's not even getting into the psychological effects of what happens when your body has an enjoyable physical response during an assault or rape, which torments victims of all ages for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it feels violating in so many ways because it's absolutely not what you're feeling, but it's also what your body is feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to consider this going forward because I believe the impacts Dean has on both David and Wayne may overlap, but I also think there's a lot of difference. And David being in such a specific area of development and having more of that like caregiver role model relationship at the beginning of his relationship with Dean likely adds a lot of inner conflict that we want to touch on. But we also want to talk about grooming, because as we talk about Dean, some of it does seem stereotypically pedophilic, but there are parts that you might be thinking aren't inherently bad. Is giving candy to a kid predatory? Of course not. Everybody does it every Halloween.
I was just going to say, if so, in a few weeks, we're all getting in trouble.
Right. But what all of this does is point to signs of grooming. And grooming is a phrase widely used in these cases, but not necessarily explained. Grooming is a set of behaviors from the offender that can be used to detect when an adult may be trying to victimize a child. This is so important because it means prevention and not waiting until there are bruises or concerning behavior from children who have already been victimized. Sometimes there's no way to know for sure, but identifying grooming is a way to be preventative rather than reactive for the kids that we love in our life. According to safekidsthrive.org, for someone to victimize a child, four things have to happen. One, they have to have the desire to sexually abuse a child. Two, they have to overcome the internal inhibitions that would ordinarily keep one from acting on said desires towards children. Three, they have to have the opportunity to be alone with the child. And four, they have to overcome the child's resistance. Grooming refers specifically to steps 3 and 4, having that access and overcoming that resistance with a specific child. While it can take anywhere from days to years, apparently the average time for a child to be groomed is about 1.5 years. So for David, that's right on track.
Absolutely.
During this time, the predator will do 3 things that relate to the grooming process. This includes the physical or psychological grooming of the child, the psychological grooming of their family, and the grooming of the community. We will make sure to link this for you in that sources document, but I heavily recommend reviewing this to view what kind of behaviors and how offenders can physically and psychologically desensitize their victims, their families, and communities to touch, and exposing children to sexual themes, topics, and behaviors, but also what they do to create an environment in which the time and access they have to those kids isn't questioned by their family or community. That they're like, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. here, take my child. Because
exactly.
Nobody who thinks their child is going to get hurt with someone is going to send them off with that person.
Oh, of course not. I think a lot of times predators find fields where it is acceptable and also like necessary for an adult and a child to be alone.
Right.
Like if a teacher is alone with a child in a classroom, that makes sense to you.
Right.
Versus a sales associate being alone. You know what I mean? Where it is just kind of like there are certain fields and places of work and things like that where it does kind of make sense. And I feel like Dean kind of fits into this, not in that like his business makes sense, but that he has kind of opened the doors to like, I'm just going to give out free stuff and please like come on up. And it happens to be kids who don't get it otherwise.
Right.
So he's kind of fostering this like community relationship where like, it's not weird to see kids lined up outside of the candy store because Dean's going to give them free candy. He's just a nice guy. He's got extra.
Right. And I think that's the other thing. Like he has,
that's the grooming of the community part too.
Right. And the families where they're like, well, my kid friggin' is obsessed with Jawbreakers. Of course he's going to be there.
Right. And I also think that for some in this specific case, there are some families who just didn't know.
Right.
Who just didn't care. And others were like, I don't care where he is. He's not bothering me.
Right.
Which was an awful way to look at it. But I think that it was true in some of these cases that they had so many mouths to feed. They had so much that if their kid wasn't home.
Right.
That was okay. And they're
like, okay. But also, you know, you think of Dean. He's got a good job. He has positive reviews from peers, right? Like people aren't saying he's a fucking freak and you should look out for him. They're like, oh no, he's a nice guy, he's quiet, kind of weird, but he's good, he's honorably discharged, like he has a good reputation. So
yeah, why wouldn't he?
Why? Yeah. And at this point in time, why would any of them kind of go, this seems weird?
He's young enough, he's close with his mom, he's a business owner, he is a veteran, he's polite enough, he's not bothering anyone, he's not loud, he's not right. Any of those things that would normally be like, stay away from him.
And also, like you said, sort of overlapped with not only the struggles of the area but also a lot of the attitudes towards children. Like at this point in my head, the only people who should be a little bit weirded out are David's parents, because they're like, if it was my child, I'd be like, why are you constantly with this man? But that being said, I think I would have a stronger sort of monitoring and supervision plan for my child. So who knows? It could be any number of things.
But would you in the late 60s, early 70s?
And would I, if I were divorced from my partner who has them half the time? And would I trust my partner to have that same standard? You never know.
You just don't.
So one reason this is important is that much of this grooming process relies on this time alone with a minor for all of this to happen. During this time in history, like we just said, the parenting views were generally different, and Houston itself was overrun with missing children. It had almost no resources and super limiting legislation. And not to mention, even if parenting was at the same standard in individual households, the opportunities for jobs, technology to stay in contact after leaving, even for a viable reason, and age where children started to leave home or start to work were all different and more limited than they are today. So when Dean shifted into grooming older children, he found access to an even more vulnerable set of the child population that was already getting more freedom and less supervision to help facilitate his grooming process. This, as a whole, meant that it wasn't so unheard of for parents to not have their kids on tight supervision or constant contact like today.
So when David's dad kicked him out of the house, because he did, David moved in with his mother, but was regularly going back and forth to Houston to visit his dad and likely Dean.
Right.
So he's like not living with him anymore. He's mostly staying with his mom. But if he's not with his mom, she probably assumes he's with the dad.
Right.
But in all likelihood, really, he's with Dean. The two of them maintained the relationship they had. In 1969, David met Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., who went by Wayne, fair.
Yeah.
and dropped out of high school. David ended up moving in with his dad in the Heights, but again, it's also believed that this was more so just with Dean, And David would let himself into Dean's apartment and was sort of this regular fixture there. It was not rare for David to just show up at Dean's apartment because that was kind of the relationship they had by this point.
Right.
This has been going on for years now. And David is actually the one that made the introduction between Wayne and Dean.
Right.
To back up to before Wayne entered the picture, though, let's focus on David and Dean. Because on December 13th, 1970, David let himself into Dean's apartment, as he had done many times before. But this time, David walked in to find two naked boys. One tied to Dean's bed, and the other strapped to Dean's torture board.
Mm-hmm.
This board, which is later seen in evidence photographs, was an 8-foot-long, 2-foot-wide wooden slab with holes in all four corners where the victim's wrists and ankles would be secured with handcuffs and rope. He would torture his victims for hours or even days at a time. The more he liked a victim, the longer he kept them alive. David Brooks walked into the apartment to find this scene, and then he left. Consider the confidence that Dean had in David that he wouldn't go run to the police. The hold he knew he had on this boy.
Yeah.
That David could walk in and see one of the most disturbing images any of us can imagine. And yet he did nothing to stop it. David didn't yell at Dean to free them or try to do it himself or call for help. He simply left. And then he went back later. If he did go to the police, though, would they have believed him? Would anyone? Who would believe the loner nerd over the kind businessman? Houston was literally coined the murder capital of the country. It was murder town, with a lot of violence, and a lot of the police force was saddled with limited resources and many officers who wouldn't or couldn't do their jobs effectively. The focus was usually on the crimes blatantly in front of them and not the ones that may or may not have been happening and probably not to have been taken seriously if a 12-year-old reported them. Maybe David thought no one would believe him, but it's more likely that he didn't turn Dean in because Dean was all he had. It's heartbreaking to say, but Dean's confirmed victim count is enormous. And the unconfirmed suspected list seems just as long. Because of this, when we do talk about Dean's victims, we're not going to go into each individual victim. Partially because we don't know specifically what happened to all of them, and we don't want to speculate or editorialize their very real horrors inflicted on innocent young men. Instead, we want to give you an overview of how Dean typically operated, and how he would lure them in, and what he did once he had them. Dean would lure his victims to him in a number of ways, either by using David, or later Wayne, to assist him in this, or just by hosting the parties himself and inviting who he wanted. It wasn't uncommon for Dean to take teenagers on an excursion, sometimes down to the southern part of the state, or to beaches, or other things to do to just get away. Yeah. Again, opportunities these kids didn't have with their families, so it was even more special to get to do it then. Once he had a desired victim, he would tighten his grasp. Dean closed the candy company and he was working as an electrician at the Houston Lighting and Power Company, a respectable job that paid well. He even moved up to a supervisory role. So he kind of insulated himself in these blue and white collar jobs, and this earned him respect among the community. He had a reliable paycheck, he was paid well. No longer using the candy company to access the younger victims, his preference seemed to have shifted to tweens, teens, and young adults.
Yeah.
He lured victims in by hosting these parties, but also offering rides.
Ugh.
He would ply them with alcohol or drugs, or sometimes both, and wait for them to pass out. Or he would trick them into a compromised position that they would unknowingly be going along with.
Right.
John Wayne Gacy was well known for the handcuff trick, where he would put handcuffs on his own wrist, keep the key hidden, and then unlock them. And he told the victim that they couldn't get out of them like he did, and they would say they could. And they would willingly put the handcuffs on their own wrists, and then they would realize that they couldn't get out. He would show them the key and that he had it. And worse, that John wasn't letting them out.
Yeah.
And then the panic would set in. Dean used this same trick. And maybe that offers more credit to this theory of a larger network. But the fear his victims felt in those first few moments was nothing compared to what was coming. Dean would strip his victims naked, secure them to his bed or the torture board, and subject them to hours or even days of torture. This torture consisted of, again, trigger warning here, sexual assault, sexual mutilation, and beatings. The end came in the form of strangulation or via a .22 caliber bullet to the head. After they were dead, they were often wrapped in plastic wrap and disposed of in various places. Dean, with the help of his accomplices, buried his known victims in a few different places. A boat shed, two beaches, one on the Bolivar Peninsula and the other in Jefferson County, and then this woodland area near Lake Sam Rayburn.
Yeah, and just here it is, big flashing trigger warning for graphic torture. We did want to make sure that we were doing a thoughtful job representing these victims and their experiences. Like Ali said, we could do a very brief overview of every victim that's confirmed, and even that's not doing enough to give them real justice, nor could we do it in any less than probably like 80 different parts. However, I don't think we'd be doing it justice to just not highlight the things these boys had to go through. And while being groomed, raped, and murdered is more than enough to have to go through, they had to endure significantly more than that. I might struggle a little to get through this, but if these children had to go through this pain, we can at the very least bear witness by hearing it. Skip here. If you are not in a place for some of this, just press the 15 seconds thing a couple times. Okay. Multiple of Dean's victims had evidence of all of their pubic hair being forcibly ripped out, or bite marks on their genitals. Some of Dean's victims had multiple large objects forced into their rectum, and others had object inserted into their penises. Sometimes this included glass rods that were later shattered by blunt force trauma while inserted. The last of the gory torture I will share is that other victims were found castrated, and at least one was even found with half of his penis chewed off. Fucking chewed. You guys know we always try to put ourselves in the shoes of everyone in these cases. With serial killers and particularly sadistic ones, I think it's part of why serial killers become so notorious, because the bandwidth we have only ever goes so far. So we usually try to use it to figure out why or how this person could or did do the things they did. But just sit here for a minute and fucking imagine this. These are tweens. These are seventh graders. These are ninth graders. These are kids that are worried about making JV versus varsity. And they are being not only murdered, not only raped prior, but tortured to an extent that they are living through some of the most horrific things I've ever had to say out loud. These kids are annoyed their parents are making them work or getting dragged to church functions, and they are being lured, attacked, and stripped of their free will, comfort, and literally any peaceful perception of this world before going through some horrendously painful and violating torture, only to likely find relief in the strangulation or gunshots that ended their life. And I am so sorry to have to talk about this, because I know that it's hard to hear and there are family members that have to hear this and think about it, but it's just not right to bury how much these kids went through. And I don't want the hell and actual reality of these kids' experiences getting lost in the analyzing and the attempts of understanding a man who gave out free fucking candy. He's a fucking monster.
Referring to the boys that David saw in Dean's apartment, we believe that it's 14-year-old James Glass and 14-year-old Danny Yates.
Yeah.
These boys were last seen December 13th, 1970, the same day David saw them, and they were last seen at a church event. It was an anti-drug youth rally hosted at the church that their families brought them to, And it was clear that the boys would rather have not been there. I mean, try finding a 14-year-old who would.
Yeah.
So they walked out to go to the bathroom, and that was the last time their families ever saw them.
When David walked in and saw these two boys, his own friends, in Dean's apartment and left, we talked about the sheer confidence Dean must have had to let him go. But beyond that, Dean was going to ensure a little gain for David for being good. In a trade for David promising not to tell anyone about what he had seen or go to the police, Dean promised David a car. And in fact, he did provide, later getting David a green Chevrolet Corvette for his 16th birthday. And that was just the beginning, because after that, David said that he started getting more. James Glass and Danny Yates were later found buried, being bound, raped, and strangled. But buried next to them were also electrical cords and alligator clips. Something likely far more traumatic than any of us care to or could bring ourselves to fully imagine happened. But David didn't know that yet, or at least if he did, he didn't let himself admit it yet. It was during this time that Dean started offering David money. I'm sure it's a slippery slope from getting a Corvette for being quiet to accepting money to deliver victims to someone, but it sure happened fast for David. Dean started giving David $200 per victim that he could lure to Dean's address. In today's money, that's over $1,600 per victim.
To a kid that probably didn't have $5.
Yes.
So, like, the temptation there is
so high.
Significant, but it's being tempted by evil.
Yeah. And again, we don't know how much graphically David saw of these first two. We know he saw enough that it's concerning that he knew something was going on, mm-hmm. but we don't know at what stage of torture or if he was there yet, or if they were being tortured yet when he walked in. Like, we don't know how much he saw, just that he saw it. You
just
know?
That no matter what he saw enough.
Yeah, he knew it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But for David, this alluring price was worth it to him for the people he delivered, and there were many. In months, the missing children added up in Houston. A handful of parents strongly advocated for their children and fought to find them, not believing what they were told by police or the letters that they received from their sons saying they ran away or found a job or didn't want to come home. But sadly, for all the parents that searched, even more did not. An archived article from the New York Times said that in 1971, over 5,600 kids alone were reported missing in the Houston area.
That is absolute madness.
That's 1 year, one town. We talked last time about police being spread thin with resources and didn't keep up with the population they had, much less the ever-growing and demanding population of the area. But more than that, this article pointed out how police were overwhelmed by the sheer numbers alone, naturally. But on top of that, there were laws that kept them from being able to even attempt to capture a runaway youth unless foul play was suspected. And in a lot of these cases where there was no evidence at all, there certainly wasn't anything to suggest foul play that would even allow the police to help if they believed them. But by Dean having these boys send letters home, say that they were running away, say they didn't want to come home, that they found a job or whatever, he was essentially adding a layer of insurance that not only was there no evidence that anything bad happened, whether or not it was real, he was also now specifically providing evidence that it was not.
And what's wild about it, too, is that he was smart enough to have the kids write their own letters.
Right.
So if it, well, I mean, I don't know if this was his intention, but I mean, we think of it this way, that if they compared the handwriting from a school assignment to the one on the letter, that kid wrote it.
Right.
It's they don't insane. Know that he wrote it under duress and because he was told word for word what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
But he still wrote it. And these were kids that were like, Dad, I found a job. I'm sorry I didn't say bye, but it was just too good of an opportunity to give up.
Yeah.
Like, I think some parents, I know we'll talk about the parents a lot, I think some maybe were concerned.
Yeah, they definitely were some.
Some didn't care because they had too many mouths to feed. And I think there were others that had a bit of hope that were like, go ahead, kid, get out of here.
Right.
Like, You found a job?
Sick. We're in the murder capital of the world.
A well-paying job? Like, there might have been a sense of pride. Like, no, he made it. He right. got out of here. You know, and without ever conceptual... Without even considering the fact that it wasn't true, they were just so happy that it could be.
Right.
Which is also devastating.
Yeah. It is. And we'll see how this changes from person to person, but the families of these kids really fucking go through it. Just 6 weeks after James Glass and Danny Yates, Dean had moved apartments and ended up in a place a few miles north of the Heights. Funny, not funny, but my dyslexic brain saw the street, which is Mangum Street, but my brain read it as Magnum Street, and I was so close to a what in the hell are we compensating for comment, but apparently it's just me. Regardless, tragedy was soon to strike again. On January 30th, 1971, Dean and David found two brothers, 13 and 15-year-old Jerry and Donald Waldrop, who they intercepted on the way to the boys going to a bowling alley. David said later in a confession that he watched Dean strangle the boys. Their father, Everett, described as a burly, divorced construction worker, said that he camped out at the police department for months and the police refused to investigate, telling him, you know your boys are runaways. They lived half a mile from the church that Glass and Yates attended and were last seen at.
Oh, that just guts you.
And it was then that David dropped out of high school, too afraid to turn in his father figure, allegedly, and continue to spend more time with him. On March 9th of 1971, the two were driving when they saw 15-year-old Randall Harvey, who was a good friend of David's. David likely convinced him to throw his bike in the van, where Randall was then lured back to Dean's home, and he was then raped, tortured, and shot. To my knowledge, this is the first time David helped Dean dispose of a body, and the two buried the boy in the boat shed.
What is very strange about David and Dean at this time is initially Dean told David, well, you get me the boys, I don't kill them, I just sell them into child sex trafficking.
Right.
I don't think those were the word to use, but it's like, oh, they're going, whatever. And so it was like, if you're gonna lie to him, I feel like a lie is usually because you're trying to like cushion the blow and right. hide the depravity, where I feel like selling a like raping and torturing a kid and then yeah. selling them into sex slavery is also just as bad.
He's like, hey, don't worry about it, kid. It gets worse.
It's like, I didn't kill him. And David was still doing it then.
Yeah.
And part of me wonders, the only minute thread of this that I could tug at and see if it would come true is maybe David felt like his relationship with Dean was kind of good. Mm-hmm. And maybe he thought that he was helping other kids access that same relationship.
Yeah.
Like, Dean performed sexual acts and then paid him for it. He has a car. Like, in right. all ways, but psychologically, he's benefiting from this. That maybe David thought that that is what was happening for the other kids. And then even when he does find out that Dean is killing them, he still just keeps doing it. Like, it's yeah. just this very odd... relationship, kind of like the way that he lied initially, which the lie was almost worse than the truth, even though the truth was still worse than the lie. And yeah, I don't know.
And it's one of those that is difficult because, like, we've talked about, not on mic many a times, just like the difference between David and Wayne, which we'll talk more about later. But I struggle so much to conceptualize either of their roles in this. Like
in their ability to, how can a human do that?
Yeah. Of, is it worse to partake and help in the actual horrid acts? Or is it worse to know it's wrong and just keep coming back and saying nothing to stop it or help? Mm-hmm. And in fact, helping more people end up in this spot. So, fascinating, weird, icky feelings all around. But to my knowledge, things are just amping up here. Like, David's now not only getting paid, he's finding people, he's bringing people, and now, oh, he's keeping watch, which he has done, but now he's helping bury them too.
Yeah, his role just becomes more and more integral to the whole thing.
Right. And 2.5 months later that summer, David helped Dean strike again. They found two boys that were going to go swimming. It was either at like a beach or a pool in Freeport. These boys were 14-year-old David Hilligeist and 16-year-old Mally Winkle. Mally worked for the Coral Candy Company with Dean's mother, actually.
That is wild.
And David Hilligeist, the 14-year-old, spent so much time at the candy company as a kid that once his mother had to show up and like drag him home, he had been there so long.
Mm.
Once again, police believed this immediately to be a runaway, but David Hilligeist's family actually refused to believe it.
They were so on it from the jump.
They really were. Because the next day, the family was planning to go on a vacation, and David had saved up all his money to bring $20 with him on the trip.
Yeah.
Which is a lot. Like, if we think about 200 being over 1600, this is over 160 bucks mm-hmm. for a 14-year-old to bring. That's a lot. And he was already packed and even had like his hard-earned spending cash ready on his dresser. So his parents were like, he's not fucking running away.
He didn't run. He wouldn't have left his bag and all of his money here. Something happened to him.
Right. So David's parents, Dorothy and Fred Hilligeist, got into their car and immediately went to the beach these boys were supposed to be at and started showing everyone their son's photos.
But they never made it there.
Yeah, they never got to the beach for anyone to see them. Dorothy and Fred put out missing persons photos with a reward of $1,000 to anyone who could offer information. They hired a private investigator, and interestingly enough, they weren't obviously able to keep up with it for super long because that's a lot of money. But in the time they did have this PI, he said that the boys had been taken by someone named Chicken Joe, which is a wild statement in and of itself. But Chicken Joe allegedly provided male prostitutes to gay clients. Due to this, and this like breaks my heart, there was one night that the family, like Dorothy and Fred and their other children, went out to the town to sit outside of gay bars downtown to see if they could see their son being taken in or out of any of them.
Oh, and it's like they were on the right page,
mm-hmm.
you know, but wrong person.
Yeah. And they had no such luck. But something interesting did happen in the coming weeks. Dorothy found out that Mally, obviously like Mally being the other victim, but Mally and David were best friends, which also just makes my heart hurt about all of this. But
David Hilligeist, yeah.
Yes. Both of these victims were best friends. And David Hilligeist's mom, Dorothy, found out that Mally had a friend who drove a Plymouth GTX. And that she'd actually seen one of those with a license plate of TMF724 around her neighborhood. Now, don't ask me about cars. I don't know shit about shit. But what the cops would have known, had they bothered looking into this at all, was that the Plymouth GTX Dorothy heard about being around Mally and also saw with her own eyes driving around her neighborhood belonged to Dean.
Yep.
But, you know, the boys are runaways. So one of the boys in the neighborhood that David Hilligeist's family lived in was Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. himself. He lived not even a block away from this family. And they were actually really good friends, I guess. He would come and ask about David Hilligeist to like offer to put up the flyers. He'd ask them how it was going, if they had any word. And he often thanked Mrs. Hilligeist for the rides homes. And sometimes she'd watch over his brothers. And he was grateful for that.
Wow.
Timeline-wise, this is before Wayne gets involved. But just crazy to think about.
How small of a town it really yes. was, you know?
Yeah. Like, just geographically on a map, they are all right on top of each other. And while all of this was going on, Dean and David didn't sit still. They never did for long. In July of 1971, a 17-year-old named Donald Falcon went missing on a nearby street to his parents' apartment complex. Parts of his body were later identified. Similarly, on August 17th of 1971, Dean and David found another loose friend of David's, Reuben Watson Haney, who was walking home from a movie theater in Houston. Dean had just moved again, and the two persuaded him to come to a party he was having. Reuben's body was also later found with evidence of strangulation. And that September, Dean moved again.
He was always moving.
Always. And to be honest, like, again, we've said, everybody says good things about him. So I'm thinking he was doing this himself. Like, he's not getting evicted. People aren't, like, running him out of town. But it just sounds exhausting, if you ask me.
Yeah, moving once is enough.
Yeah, I'm good for a few years after I move.
Uh-huh.
The idea of multiple times in one summer?
No.
I'm good.
No, thank you.
Nonetheless, this time he moved into the Heights. During September, David reported having helped Dean with two abductions and murders. The identities of these victims might still be unknown, but they were certainly at the time they were discovered. We'll talk more about, like, identifying victims later on.
Mm-hmm.
But David did say that the very last victim before Wayne came in, Dean liked so much he kept him alive for 4 days. Before being
four
killed.
4 days of torture. That poor baby.
Children. I just, they're children. It's awful. But in October of 1971, David Brooks had already known Wayne because they met on a day. They were both skipping school, actually. But he brought him to Dean, likely as a victim, when something unexpected happened. Dean decided Wayne, instead of a good victim, would make a good accomplice. And unlike David, who knew what was going on, at least at this point, Dean told Wayne that he could be a pal, a confidant, and he even had a job for him if he ever needed to make a couple bucks. Not only would Dean buy anything Wayne had to sell, even if it was, like, stolen, he threw that in there, because Wayne was also from a poor family. It was just him and his mom, but Dean could do him one better than that. He was interested in running, and I shit you not, this is how he described it to him, a white slavery ring that operated out of Dallas.
Oh.
And that he'd pay Wayne $200 for every boy who could lure into that slavery ring. Again, today this is like $1,600.
Madness.
And just like that, Dean and David went from killer duo to the infamous trio. But that, dear listener, is where we're going to leave you for part two. Stay tuned next week for more information on Wayne's background and participation, the victims that we have yet to talk about, and what led to Dean's death. We will also have part four, likely, with all of the aftermath and sort of where we're at now, as well as any connections that have been made in the meantime.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That I'm just sorry. This was one of the most troubling descriptions that we've had to give, and we've only just started. So pet your pod pet. Do what you need to do. Look at our resource page on our Instagram. Look at the reprieves, because we love reprieves.
Yeah. There's
take little care pod of pets. Yourself. Do good things.
Silly little goofs. I'm so sorry, but I'm not sorry for doing it well. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like if we're going to
cover this case, then.
Yeah, if we're going to tell these kids stories, we have to be telling their stories.
Not just the comfortable details.
And not like, you know, I've seen a lot of people come out with one or two parters about sort of what happened, and they do a great job of giving as much information as you possibly can in that amount of time, but there, unless you spend way more time on it than anybody comfortably wants to, there's just no way to give these kids any semblance of the recognition or the justice they possibly could get after being stripped of all of that for so long. So like Ellie said, do good things, take care of yourself, do whatever you got to do. Our Instagram is a great place to kill a couple hours. You can see some highlights. You can see some reprieves. You can see resources.
You can see pod pets.
Yeah.
Which you should send yours if you haven't yet.
We would love to see them and post them up so that everybody else can love on them. You can tell us if you don't want us to post them. We absolutely respect that too. But other than that, you can see all the people, the places, the things that we talk about. And if you are in a space where you can keep going on a lot of this stuff, look at some of those sources that we link below. There's like a wealth of information down there that honestly will take you a lot longer than all of the ways we can combine it to put it out to you, because it'll just be over and over and over again in every source. So
yes,
feel free, take a look around, do what you can, but we hope you have a pretty good week. We hope you take care of yourselves. And if I do look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye, guys.